look now then, brethren and sisters, to Brother Ewan as we call him forward to deliver the first study in our series for this weekend, covering the history and the background of the words of the prophet. Brother Ewan, please.
So we're going to take a look then at the historical background of Zechariah. Just for a very quick summary, under the Babylonian exile, Jerusalem was surrounded by Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar's army, and they ended up being conquered by that, being taken into exile for 70 years, and then at the end of that 70 years, according to the prophecy of Jeremiah, they returned to the land of Israel, and they're able to build the walls, etc., of Jerusalem again. And at first that didn't quite go as planned. They got stopped due to opposition. But that's briefly when Zechariah and Haggai, the prophets, came along and sort of resurrected that work and make it actually come back to fruition. So just for a bit of introduction, I'd like to just really quickly just remind ourselves of that invasion that was prior to the Babylonian exile, the Assyrian exile, because that probably will give us a little bit of a slant we might not have thought of. So you'll remember that under the Assyrian exile, just first of all, David's reign, then Solomon, then the kingdom was split, and so there was then Israel, or the northern kingdoms, the northern tribes, and then Solomon ruling Judah, Solomon's son. Each of them, each Israel and Jerusalem, or Judah, had 20 kings each, a total of 40 kings. It's, the same chance, if you like. They both got 20 kings, and that 40 is a time of trial and testing throughout Scripture. Israel didn't have any faithful kings at all, and so they were eventually captured or overtaken by the Syrian Empire in 721 AD. So the Syrian Empire stretched across the whole of the Middle East as a vast empire, and the one thing they didn't manage to conquer was Jerusalem. If you remember from Isaiah, they were just about at the brink of conquering Jerusalem. They actually did surround the city, and they boasted about how they've swept across the whole of the Middle East. If you just turn to Isaiah 36, just quickly, we'll just remind ourselves of just how close Jerusalem was to being captured. Remember, Israel, the northern kingdoms, had already been captured by this time. And so imagine the whole of the Assyrian army is now surrounding Jerusalem. You're just in Jerusalem and you're holding out in Isaiah 36 and verses 14 to 20. Humanly speaking, it looks inevitable that Jerusalem is going to be conquered. And so Rabshakeh says, "Thus says the king of Assyria, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in Yahweh, saying, Yahweh will surely deliver us. This city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Hearken not to Hezekiah. For thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me by a present, and come out to me, and eat you every one of his vine, and every one of his fig tree, and drink you every one of the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like unto your own, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards. Beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, Yahweh will deliver us. Hath any of the gods of the nations delivered this land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? And have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Who are they among all the gods of these lands that have delivered their land out of my hand, that Yahweh should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand?" So that whole siege of the Assyrian army, humanly speaking, it looked inevitable that Jerusalem would be conquered. And yet Hezekiah was a very faithful king at that time. He held out, he prayed to God. Remember the verse where he spreads that letter out before God. And so at that point, Isaiah the prophet is told to go and tell Hezekiah that everything is going to be okay. Jerusalem literally stood at the brink of destruction, hopelessly outnumbered. But Isaiah the prophet goes to tell, if you just turn over the chapter, Isaiah 37, and verses 21 to 23. Then Isaiah the son of Amoz said unto Hezekiah, saying, "Thus saith Yahweh Elohim of Israel, whereas thou hast prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word which Yahweh hath spoken concerning him. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee, and laughed thee to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem hath shaken her head at thee. Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thine eyes on high, even against the Holy One of Israel? And so Isaiah says, forget the Assyrians, Hezekiah, you're not even going to go into battle against them. Jerusalem won't be taken, and they're all, it's just not a problem. And then that night, 185,000 of the Assyrian army, probably the entire army, everyone that they had sent to Jerusalem, was killed. Just a few verses later, verse 33 of that chapter. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into the city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with shields, nor cast a bank against it. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into the city, saith Yahweh. For I will defend the city to save it for mine own sake, and for my servant David's sake. Then the angel of the Lord went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians, 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed, and went and returned, and dwelt at Nineveh. And it came to pass, as he was worshipping in the house of Nisroch his god, that Adramelech and Sharazer his son smote him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Armenia, and Esarhaddon his son reigned in his stead. So suddenly, from what looked like, you know, almost as if Assyrian army couldn't fail to conquer Jerusalem, the next night they're all dead, and the king himself had been killed by his own sons. So through faith, Hezekiah, and clearly Isaiah the prophet as well, sort of, you might say, they saved the day and made sure that Jerusalem wouldn't be conquered under the Assyrian siege. So we've got to remember that's a sort of forerunner to the Babylonian siege. It was only about 135 years prior to the Babylonian invasion under Nebuchadnezzar when the stunning victory had happened under the Assyrian Empire. So that's not a lot of time. It's only about three or four generations earlier. 135 years is about the time, for example, between us and Brother Roberts in 1880, or Queen Victoria. So whereas those events, and Robert Roberts are not quite within living memory, but only three or four generations away, you know, your great-grandfather might well personally remember Robert Roberts. So the events of the Assyrian Empire were only that distance away. So those who were faithful would probably remember their great-grandfathers telling them, look, you know, the entire Assyrian army came against Jerusalem. We were faithful. God wouldn't let the holy city be destroyed. So that's a little bit of the background to the Babylonian exile. So when the Babylonian army, 135 years later, now again surrounds Jerusalem, and Israel, the northern tribes, have already gone into captivity by this time, it was only three or four generations later. So the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar, they also swept across the whole of the Middle East. They also, you know, conquered city after city. They also conquered all the gods of the surrounding nations. And they also came against Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon at that time. This time it wasn't Rabshakeh, it was Nebuzaradan, the chief of executioners. He was in Jerusalem about to execute everyone who stood against him, presumably. So if you were a kind of regular person, what would you have imagined if the entire Babylonian army now came against Judah? You knew this was the holy city. This was the city that God had set his eye upon. You knew that just three or four generations later, you'd probably seen all this before with the Assyrian army. If you were faithful, maybe put that in quotes, you would think to yourself, well, God is going to save this city. He's not going to let Jerusalem fall to these, you know, heathen Babylonians, etc. And so he'll save us just like he saved us from the Assyrians all those years ago. So that's what probably everyone would think. Everyone would think that Jerusalem was going to be spared. But then along comes Jeremiah. He's the only prophet at the time who's saying, you know, this is not going to happen according to what you hope. We are going to be taken into captivity. Nebuchadnezzar is going to come. He's going to burn the city with fire. We're actually going to be taken into captivity, taken en masse out of the land of Israel, away from Jerusalem, going to a land that we don't speak the language of, etc. But we are going to come back after 70 years. So you can imagine how unpopular Jeremiah was for saying all those things. We don't really have time to look at just how unpopular Jeremiah was and all the opposition that he got. But you can imagine people would be saying, you're a traitor, you know, this is the holy city, you should be more faithful, you should encourage the people, not discouraging words about, you know, Jerusalem's going to go into exile, etc. So if we turn to Jeremiah chapter 25, categorically, in many places, Jeremiah tells us, no, you are going to go into exile. The king of Babylon is going to come and you are going to succumb to him. Jeremiah repeatedly says, do what the king of Babylon says. So in Jeremiah 25, verse 11, Jeremiah says, and this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. So Jeremiah categorically says that you're going to go into exile and be conquered by the king of Babylon. If we turn also to 2 Chronicles in chapter 36 and verse 21. Second Chronicles chapter 36 and verse 21. It says, to fulfill the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land hath enjoyed her Sabbaths, for as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath, to fulfill 70 years. So because they had been unfaithful and hadn't been keeping the Sabbaths and hadn't been faithful to God, the land was going to be left for 70 years in order for it to be, you know, to keep those Sabbaths. So repeatedly Jeremiah says this is not going to work out according to how it did in the time of the Assyrians, and Jerusalem is going to be burnt with fire, the land will be desolate, you will be taken to Babylon, etc. So Jeremiah actually buys land as a witness against him. You know, on the very brink of war, everyone would be trying to sell up to make sure that money and escape, etc. Jeremiah is actually buying land as a witness that he will be returning in 70 years. We also note that Nebuchadnezzar used a lot of social engineering practices. He brought all the nobles and intelligentsia to Babylon, from Daniel, for example. You know, Daniel was a young man, he sought all the king's seat and all the clever people, brought them en masse over to Babylon. He changed their name. So if you just briefly go to Daniel chapter 1, it was an early social cleansing type of exercise. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem, and besieged it. Verse 3. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seat, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favoured and skilled in all wisdom and cunning in knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. So all the clever people, the good-looking people, somebody who can stand in front of a king, people who are already well-favoured and healthy-looking and intelligent, and all those people, he takes en masse and brings them to Babylon and kind of re-engineers their minds, if you like. He gets all their Hebrew names, like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and he gives them new names, Babylonian names, names which reflect the Babylonian gods, etc. And over again, we see these names sort of changing to try to make you forget your homeland. He gave you of the king's meat so that you start to think, oh, you know, we're really privileged here, we shouldn't speak against him, he's being good to us. But meanwhile, Nebuchadnezzar got all the poor people of the land, the people who actually did all the work of harvesting, etc., and he left them there. So all the rich rulers would be taken away and they would be left. So they would now start to feel loyal towards Babylon because they were given more authority than before. The rich overlords would be taken away. They were probably given the land and said, you know, you till it and eat all the ground, etc. So it was a clever policy of making people feel that they liked the Babylonians, who would start to settle there. So just going back to the exile, so Jeremiah categorically said, you are going to go into Babylon for 70 years. So just imagine, you know, in your mind, sort of let 70 years tick by in your mind, and imagine that time has now ticked by, and it's about the time that that 70 years is starting to be fulfilled. If you just turn again to Jeremiah chapter 25, Jeremiah not only said that you're going to go into Babylon, for 70 years, that you're going to return after 70 years. So Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 12, "And it shall come to pass when 70 years are accomplished, that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, saith the Lord, for their iniquity, and the land of the Chaldeans, and will make it perpetual desolations." Just a few chapters later, Jeremiah 29 and verse 10, "For thus saith Yahweh, that after 70 years be accomplished at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good work towards you, in causing you to return to this place." So Jeremiah says, you're going to return after 70 years. In other words, when those 70 years had come to an end, Babylon had fallen to the Medes and the Persians, you know, the arms of silver in Daniel chapter 2, and after jointly reigning with Darius for 2 years, Cyrus was now ruling over the empire. And there's a sequence of quite amazing events here that mean that the Jews are elevated into positions of authority just at that crucial time of around the time of Cyrus. And there's quite a range of amazing events that God brings to pass to make sure that that's the case. For example, we'll remember well, probably from Sunday school as well, that in Daniel chapter 5, the writing in the wall chapter, that Daniel was elevated to the third place in the kingdom. Belshazzar, the king, is having this feast, and he, to all his nobles and all his victories, etc., etc., and he decides to blaspheme, to bring out all the cups of gold and silver, etc., including ones that were taken from the temple. And as he's drinking all this, you know, lavish feast, etc., a hand, or it actually says part of a hand, it's probably just fingers or something, fingers appear in the wall and start to just write something. And at first, probably no one noticed that writing, until eventually they started to see it. And you can imagine how frightening it would be to see part of somebody's hand writing stuff. So they can't interpret it at first, they don't understand it. But Daniel, of course, comes in. He's would be an old man by this time, but he understood it. I like to think that Hebrew and Aramaic are different scripts at this time, and probably it was written in the Hebrew script that the Jews, Daniel, would understand, of which the, you know, Aramaic-speaking Belshazzar wouldn't, which is why probably Daniel could, you know, read and understand the words. But anyway, in Daniel chapter 5, the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers, and the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." So Daniel then understands what's written and he's now elevated to the third position in the kingdom. Belshazzar would then be destroyed and so Daniel's now elevated to position number two. So that when the new king comes in, he would say, well, who's in charge here? And Daniel is then at the very brink of power for the new king. Remember at this time as well that Esther was elevated to the position of queen through a unique and remarkable series of circumstances where Vashti is deposed and Esther is then brought, elevated to the position effectively of queen. We also find at that same sort of time Mordecai, a Jew, you know, ruling in very high positions of power, but he overhears a plot to kill the king's, or to kill the king, and he tells the king about it, and so he's later rewarded for that. So we have a unique sequence of circumstances where Jews happen to be elevated into positions of power, so that when the 70 years is fulfilled, they're already thoroughly, thoroughly trusted by the ruling authorities. There's Esther, you know, the most beautiful person available at the time. There's Mordecai, who's actually proved that he's faithful by unveiling the plot to king the kill, to kill the king. There's Daniel, who's now elevated into the third ruler of the kingdom. Nehemiah is the king's cupbearer. So there's a unique cluster of circumstances around the end of the 70 years with Daniel, Esther, Mordecai, and Nehemiah, and lots of others as well, who are all elevated into positions of power and authority to further God's plan and purpose. So for these reasons, Cyrus was tolerant to the Jews. He soon issues a decree inviting the Jewish exiles to return to Israel and to rebuild the temple. If we turn to Ezra in chapter 4, and just read the first few verses of that. Ezra chapter 1. Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, and he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, Yahweh Elohim of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? His God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel. He is the God, which is in Jerusalem. And whoso remaineth in any place where he sojourneth, let the men of his place help him with silver, and with gold, and with goods, and with beasts, beside the freewill offering for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. So Cyrus is the one who is given the ability to command, not just allow, but to actually command the Jews to go back at the end of the 70 years. But also, I'll just read you this verse, that Daniel, a prophet in Israel for 70 years, constantly poring over the holy writings that existed at this time, he twigs one day that 70 years is fulfilled. Daniel would understand the times very clearly, but in Daniel chapter 9, in verse 2, it says, In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood my books, the number of the years, whereof the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. So Daniel would be aware that they were in Babylon for 70 years, and by a sequence of repeatedly reading Jeremiah's prophecy, looking at the dates, etc., he realises that now is the time that they're going to return to Babylon. So all these wondrous events happen at the same time to bring them back to the land of Israel. It was also known, predicted, prophesied by Isaiah, that Cyrus would be the one who would... You know, that king would be the one who would tell the Jews to return to their land. I'll just read you Isaiah chapter 44 and verse 28. Isaiah 44 and verse 28. That saith of Cyrus, He is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, Thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. So Isaiah said that Cyrus would be the one, the king, that would make the Jews go back to the land. Isaiah also refers to Cyrus as being God's anointed, the Messiah, because he was a type of Christ in returning the Jews, restoring them after the exile and building the temple. So all these astonishing sequence of events lead to that 70 years as being a time when lots of things happened together to be the time that the Jews would now return back to the land. And under Daniel, they knew this time was being fulfilled. It would be a really exciting time. In that introductory reading, we read from Psalm 126, which was when they would understand that this time was now fulfilled. And as we read through that psalm, we get a real feeling of the excitement at this time. Those who were faithful realised they were actually going to return to the land of Israel after 70 years of Babylon. When the Lord turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream. Then was our mouth filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. Then said they among the heathen, The Lord hath done great things for them. And it goes on to say, The Lord hath done great things for us. So there was a real excitement at this time. They realised that the 70 years were fulfilled. They were going to go back to the land of Israel. They were going to start to build the temple again. Cyrus had blessed it. You know, the two people mostly involved at this time, Zerubbabel and Joshua, organised that return. They're also interesting people. Zerubbabel, his name in Hebrew means foreigner in Babel. So he knew he was a foreigner. He didn't feel like he belonged to Babylon. He was called Sheshbazzar. So he's a Hebrew name, Zerubbabel, but he's then given an Aramaic name, a Babylonian name, to make him feel like he's a Babylonian. For his whole life, he keeps on saying Zerubbabel. So he knows doesn't belong in Babylon. So just as Daniel's three friends, Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah, were given Babylonian names to make them feel patriotic towards Babylon and make them forget the land of their nativity, Zerubbabel also is given a pagan Babylonian name to forget their homeland. Sheshbazzar was, Zerubbabel was a descendant of David, if you look at the genealogies. Joshua was the high priest at the time. So together they are, you know, a representative of David being king and Joshua being a type of Christ, the high priest, the Messiah, who's later going to redeem his people. So together they represent prophet, priest, and king. There were something like 49,000 Israelites returned at this time. We'll just very briefly go to Ezra and chapter 2. Ezra in chapter 2 and verses 64 and 65. The whole congregation together was 42,300. Beside their servants and their maids, of whom there were 7,337, and there were among them 200 singing men and singing women. So a huge number returned at this time, including Haggai and Zechariah. So just think the faith of these people starting to return after the 70 years. They'd spent the last 70 years of their life, pretty much everything they'd known in their lives, families, careers, everything in Babylon, pretty much everything they'd ever known, and they were coming back to the land of Israel under faith. And it was a real journey of faith. It was physically a long way to walk, but also only the old would actually remember Israel. It took them 4 months to get back. We find that in one of the verses. They knew that Yahweh was with them. They knew that Jews at this time were being blessed by being in power, allowing all these things to happen. They were backed by all the power, the might, the wealth of King Cyrus and the whole of the Persian government. Cyrus was commanding them to come back and giving them money, etc. You know, they were financially blessed. And they were allowed to bring back all the vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had taken. Nehemiah carefully counts everything out to make sure that not one single thing is lost. So it seemed like it was an absolutely fantastic time. How could they fail? They had everything they needed. They had, you know, blessed by the Cyrus. It was a wonderful time where lots of coincidences were happening to allow them to return. You know, humanly speaking, you'd think, how can they possibly fail in this endeavour to get back to Israel, to Jerusalem, and rebuild the temple, and rebuild, restock, etc. When we actually go back to Ezra and Nehemiah, we find that when they do arrive, there's a lot of bad things that they're met with. So, for example, they find that the cities in Judah are all neglected and that Jerusalem is just lying in ruins and rubble. The site of the temple is just a burnt mass of rubble, essentially. Nehemiah, we later find that the people are completely and utterly corrupted after 70 years of having no rule over them. The people are corrupted, the nobles are corrupted, they've intermarried, including the priests. Some of the priests are not just intermarried, but they can't even prove that they're eligible to be priests at all, you know, when the genealogies are taken. In Nehemiah's time, there's an Ammonite actually living in the temple. It's completely outrageous. You know, the nobles and leaders of the people are actively discouraging the people from working. There's opposition all around when they get back from the surrounding nations, like the Ammonites and the Arabs, etc. And there's a growing hostility when that faithful generation started to come back and to rebuild the temple and the walls. You can imagine that all the local people living in Israel who'd, you know, swarmed in after the exile, their enemies didn't want to see a powerful Judah arising again on their borders. You know, anti-Semitism has worked for centuries in that regard. So even though they knew they were being blessed, and even though in theory this should have been the best return could ever imagine, you know, the most blessed, the quickest, the most faithful, you know, they do have some success in clearing the temple of all the rubble and starting to rebuild the walls again. But unfortunately, they just didn't quite have that faith to push through all those problems and opposition. Just think for a minute, I don't know if anyone's heard of the Lost Gardens of Heligan in Cornwall. But it was an old, very wealthy garden around the time of the Second World War. Lots of, you know, fantastic things in it. Very expensive private grounds. In the Second World War, all the people were whisked off to war and probably didn't come back. And so the whole gardens were overrun just with weeds and trees and everything else. And that's a little bit like what it would be like in Jerusalem. The temple wasn't. It was destroyed, it was burnt, etc. Rubble started to get in. and just clearing all that rubble would be like, you know, uncovering the lost gardens of Heligan, where you're always uncovering more and more, getting down to the ground level and starting to uncover it all. It's just a huge amount of work, in other words. Some of those people who were returning would remember Solomon's temple in the height of its glory. If we turn to Ezra in chapter 3, for example, Ezra chapter 3 and verses 8 to 13. Now in the second year of their coming unto the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month began Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua the son of Jozadak, and the remnant of their brethren, the priests and the Levites, and all they that were come out of the captivity unto Jerusalem, and appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to set forward the work of the house of the Lord. Then said Joshua with his sons and his brethren, Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah together, to set forward the workmen in the house of God, the sons of Henadad, with their sons and their brethren, the Levites. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise Yahweh after the ordinance of David, king of Israel. And they sang together by course in praising and giving thanks unto Yahweh, because he is good, and for his mercy endureth forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout, and they praised Yahweh, because the foundation of the house of Yahweh was laid. And many of the priests, the Levites, and the chief of the fathers, who were ancient men, that had seen the first house, when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. So the joy and excitement at this time of actually laying the foundations of the temple, when there was, you know, old people there who actually remembered leaving Israel 70 years prior and now coming back, you know, they would understand just how blessed this was. So on the surface of it, this appeared to be a fantastic, wonderful time. Everything was blessed. It's just amazing when you clear all that rubble away, start to really get a feeling of how the temple is going to be built again, start to really see it being built. All those old people, you know, weeping for joy at just being able to see the temple in its glory again. All the things it's spoken of down through those 70 years in captivity were now starting to be fulfilled. Except the one big problem is that they start to meet opposition with adversaries and so on. In the Bible School at High, we looked at Nehemiah and all the opposition that Nehemiah faced. And we also find that in Ezra. Just in this next chapter, Ezra chapter 4, it's worth just reading that to get an insight into what exactly was happening at this time. So the local people who had sort of moved into Judah didn't like this idea that the temple was going to be built, that Jews were going to come back in huge numbers and start to, you know, kind of oust them and build the temple again, get sacrifices going again, and get Jerusalem built again. So there was opposition. Look at Ezra chapter 4 and just read that. Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple unto the Lord God of Israel, then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said unto them, Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do, and we do sacrifice unto him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Asher, or Assyria, which brought us up hither. And so first the adversaries tried to kind of deal subtlety, let's pretend that we're going to help you with the work. The idea probably was to sort of sabotage it from within in some way. It's a little bit like that principle, a little leaven leavens the whole lump. Once you start getting enemies in who don't really believe these things, then it just creeps in unawares. And that's what the adversaries wanted. They wanted to, you know, leaven the lump, so to speak, start to pretend to help and start to sabotage it from within. Zerubbabel refuses to let that happen. In verse 3, Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the chief of the fathers of Israel said unto them, Ye have nothing to do with us to build an house unto our God, but we ourselves together will build unto the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, hath commanded us. So they are reminding adversaries there that this is not just them doing this off their own back, but Cyrus the king has commanded them to do it. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building, and hired counsellors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. It's something like a 15-year period that they stop building for due to all this opposition. We don't know the details of how they did this, how they weakened the hands and hired counsellors, but probably they're starting to look at all this building work and, you know, tutting and saying, oh, I wouldn't do it that way, I would do it this way, knowing that some other way will just, you know, not be good. Everything, you can imagine, every single ploy that they're thinking of to try to get the work either to cease or to be bad. You know, years later, Nehemiah, the people said, oh, you know, look at the wall. If a fox goes on it, it's going to, you know, fall down because it's so weak. You can imagine they're probably trying to get all this building work to get the worst possible way it can possibly go. But in the end, they don't quite manage it. They have to start to resolve to outright lies to get the temp. To get this work stopped. So when you go down to verse 7, and in the days of Artaxerxes, wrote Bishlam, Mithridath, and Tabiel, and the rest of their companions unto Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the writing of the letter was written in the Syrian tongue, and interpreted in the Syrian tongue. Rehum the counselor, and Shimshai the scribe, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes, the king, in this sort. Then wrote Rehum the chancellor, and Shimshai the scribe, and the rest of their companions, the Dinites, and the Apharsachites, the Tarpalites, basically everyone who's there, everyone they can think of, the Elamites, people from miles around, just everyone they can possibly get, and the rest of the nations whom the great and noble Hasnapur brought over and set in the cities of Samaria, and the rest that are on this side of the river, and at such a time. This is the copy of the letter that were sent unto him, even unto Artaxerxes the king. Thy servants the men on this side the river, and at such a time. Be it known unto the king, that the Jews which came up from thee to us are come into Jerusalem, building the rebellious and the bad city, and have set up the walls thereof, and joined the foundations. Be it known now unto the king, that if this city be builded, and the walls set up again, then they will not pay toll, tribute, and custom, and so thou shalt damage the revenue of the kings. Now because we have maintenance from the king's palace, and it was not meet for us to see the king's dishonour, therefore have we sent and certified the king, that search may be made in the book of the records of thy fathers. So shalt thou find in the book of the records, and know that this city is a rebellious city, and hurtful unto the kings and provinces, and that they have moved sedition within the same of the old time, for which cause was this city destroyed. We certify the king that if this city be builded again, and the walls thereof set up, by this means thou shalt have no portion on this side the river. So this whole story was just a whole pack of lies. Nothing like this was going to happen. What all those enemies of the Jews were saying is that the Jews have now started to build up the walls, etc. They're going to build, and all the revenue, the tribute that you get from this is just going to cease once they build up, and they're going to start to, you know, start to make war and rebellion against you, and we're only telling you because of your income is damaged because of this, and we get a little bit of revenue back from you. And so that whole story was just a complete pack of lies, but that was the story using legal means and legal coercion that repeatedly the enemies of the truth used to get things to stop. Remember, for example, at the time of Christ, when, you know, first the Pharisees and scribes start arguing with Christ, thinking of ways to catch him out and clever things, you know, the Sadducees with their thing of the resurrection, and there were seven women, etc., seven men and one wife, all trying to catch him out in some way. And eventually Christ answers them so well that they are just too afraid to ask him any more questions, and that's when they start to think, well, we need to get legal means to get Christ stopped. And that's when they start to find some way to entrap him. And eventually that results in using the Romans and, you know, trying to accuse Christ of insurrection, really, in some way. So that's always the way that things end up, using legal means to try to get the truth stopped when they can't use, you know, scripture. So eventually the enemies of the Jews in this chapter, they do manage to get the Jews to stop the work. Even though it looked like they were coming back under Cyrus and everything was blessed and everything should have been wonderful and they were incredibly excited at seeing all happen, they did, when they got that opposition, they did actually stop the work. I nearly said had to stop the work, but you know, it's a matter of choice whether you have to stop the work or whether you choose to stop the work. Anyway, the work was stopped for 15 years. There's a couple of verses we can show to prove that. So even though they'd come back from exile, you know, with everything, all the blessings of the exile, being blessed by the king, everything should have been wonderful. When they actually got there, they met with opposition, and that opposition meant that they stopped the building work, you know, completely for about 15 years. And that is the point at which Zechariah and Haggai come onto the scene. So, for example, they go to chapter 5, the next chapter, and just start to read the first couple of verses. After having a long pause, we now find that Zechariah and Haggai come on the scene. So just as prophets repeatedly come at crucial times, Zechariah and Haggai come on at this time. Then the prophets Haggai and the prophet and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem, in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, and with them were the prophets of God helping them. And so Haggai and Zechariah have their prophecies that we'll read through over the course of this weekend, you know, the four carpenters and the four workmen, etc., the four horns, and they say, look, you know, you shouldn't stop the work just because there's opposition. So not only do Zechariah and Haggai get the work to start again, but they themselves are actually helping. They're not just prophesying from afar. In verse 2, you know, they were with them, with the prophets of God helping them. So the prophets get their hands dirty in this work of rebuilding, just as the priests do earlier. Everyone is involved at this time. And so again, when they rebuild, they start to get opposition. Just in the next couple of verses, at the same time came to them Tatnai, governor on this side the river, and Shethar Boznai and their companions, and said thus unto them, who hath commanded you to build this house and to make up this wall? So again, the adversaries of the Jews are thinking, you know, we got the work stopped last time. If we just make up the story again about it being illegal and etc., then we'll get it stopped. Only this time, Zechariah and Haggai have the courage and backbone to stand up against their tricks. So in verse 4, then said we unto them after this manner, what are the names of the men that make this building? But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, that they could not cause them to cease, till the matter came to Darius. And then they returned answer by letter concerning this matter. The copy of the letter that Tatnai, governor on this side the river, and Shethar Boznai and his companions, the Arpachites, which are on this side the river, sent unto Darius the king. They sent a letter unto him, wherein was written thus, unto Darius the king, all peace, be it known unto the king, that we went into the province of Judea, the house of the great God, which is builded with great stones and timbers laid in the walls, and this work goeth fast on and prospereth in their hands. Then asked we those elders and said unto them, who commanded you to build this house and to make up these walls? We asked their names also to certify thee, that we might write the names of the men that were the chief of them. And thus they returned as answer, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and build the house that was builded these many years ago, which a great king of Israel builded and set up. But after that our fathers had provoked the God of heaven unto wrath, he gave them unto the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and the Chaldeans, who destroyed this house and carried the people away into Babylon. But in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Babylon, the same king Cyrus made a decree to build this house of God, and the vessels also of gold and silver of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that was in Jerusalem, and brought them into the house of Babylon. Those did Cyrus the king take out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered into one, whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he hath made governor, and said unto them, take these vessels, go carry them into the temple that is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be builded in his place. Then came the same Sheshbazzar, and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. And since that time, even until now, have it been in building, and yet it is not finished. Now therefore, if it seem good to the king, let their search be made in the king's treasure house, which is there at Babylon, and whether it be so that a decree was made of Cyrus the king to build the house of God at Jerusalem, and let the king send his pleasure to us concerning this matter. And so Darius makes a search for the records and find out that Cyrus had indeed commanded that temple to be built. And so with Zechariah and Haggai telling them to get up and do the work and standing up to all the adversaries of the Jews, it turns out that the search was made and that decree earlier of Cyrus is found. And so again, that work is restored. But it all came about because Zechariah, you know, rather than succumb to all those legal means of getting them to stop, he takes the challenge to them and says, no, Cyrus commanded us to build this. So the search is made and the work continues. And you can read through all of Ezra chapter 6, and that temple is now re-established again. So that shows just the courage that Zechariah and Haggai together had. They stood up to all the opposition that they had, all the adversaries, and managed to get the work started again. They personally were doing the building work as well. They weren't just, you know, like a foreman going round and nodding at the right time. Like the priests earlier and the prophets, they personally got involved in the work. There's a few other verses that show us the similar context. And for example, we turn to Zechariah. Just look at the first chapter. Zechariah chapter 1, and just verse 1 and verse 7. So verse 1, in the 8th month, in the 2nd year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying, the Lord hath been sore displeased with your father. And so Zechariah, his prophecy comes just at that crucial time when Darius is now in power again, or not again, but in power, and he starts to rebuild the temple. In verse 7, unto the 24th day of the 11th month, which is in the month of Shabbat, or Sebat, in the 2nd year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet. And so these happened in that early years of Darius the king. If we go back to Haggai and chapter 1, Haggai is at the same time as well. In the 2nd year of Darius the king, in the 6th month, in the 1st day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Jozadak, the high priest, saying, thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? So therefore, you see the context of this, that they'd started to build the house, but when they got all the opposition that we mentioned earlier, they then stopped it. And they then start to build their own houses, make sure their own houses are nice and sealed and comfortable, etc. And they've just left the house of Yahweh to be just, you know, abandoned as it has been. So that's the context in which Haggai and Zechariah come in with their prophecies. If you just go to verse 12 of that Haggai chapter 1. Then Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel and Joshua the son of Jozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of Yahweh their God, and the words of Haggai the prophet, as the Lord their God had sent him, and the people did fear before Yahweh. Then spake Haggai the Lord's messenger, and the Lord's message unto the people, saying, I am with you, saith the Lord. And the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. And they came and did work in the house of the Lord of hosts, their God, in the 24th day of the 6th month, in the 2nd year of Darius the king. So having Haggai and Zechariah the prophets is just enough to give them that impetus. They're told that God is with you, even though, you know, looked for a while like the adversaries had prevailed, God is with you. So the prophets managed to spur the people on. The same Jozadak and Zerubbabel that earlier had come back with enthusiasm had given up as soon as they had met, you know, adversaries and opposition. They're now stirred up to do the work again, and they're explicitly told that God is with them. So that's the context in which Zechariah and Haggai are given. They come in that gap between when the opposition comes and they spur the people on to work again. During this whole episode of thinking what happened here, there's perhaps a really interesting sort of exhortation for us. Because just as at the time the people thought that in theory everything should be right, you know, they were blessed in so many different ways. You know, the end of the 70 years had come, there was lots of circumstances telling them, just crying out that this is the time when you're going to be blessed, you know, with Mordecai and Esther and Nehemiah and Daniel, etc. They knew from prophecy it was the right time as well. You know, the 70 years, Daniel knew by books that in Jeremiah's 70 years were fulfilled. Not only that, but you know, they got the blessing of Cyrus and all the financial wealth and power and might behind it to command them to return. You know, humanly speaking, everything was just perfect. It had to be a perfect blessing to return and build the temple. And you would think that in a situation like that, things should just go incredibly smoothly because God is blessing you so much. And yet they got opposition, and that opposition was bad enough to get them to stop. And they just stopped and gave up. You know, sometimes what they should have done is just push through that opposition. They gave up and started building their own houses. And Zechariah and Haggai had to come back and remind them, you know, God is with you. Keep going. And that's when they managed to keep the work going. So Zechariah and Haggai had to come along and say, look, just because you've got opposition, it doesn't mean that God has forgotten you. You're still blessed. And there's probably a lesson there that, you know, many times in our lives we'll think we're doing the right thing, that God is going to bless us in a certain plan of action. But we will meet opposition. But the lesson here is that when you do meet opposition and things are right as far as everything is concerned, it doesn't mean that you just say, oh well then, you know, let's just give up. It's obviously not God's plan. You should push through that. That's the time when we can show faith and courage to push through all those difficult circumstances in life and show that we're prepared and willing to overcome all the problems and opposition that the world throws at us. Those things aren't necessarily evidence that God isn't with us after all, but rather they're showing us that we can show how faithful we are. That's probably the biggest lesson of all of Zechariah and Haggai. Often when opposition comes, we need to push through that if we are, you know, are blessed by God.